So let's start the meeting. Honorable Neil Data, APF Executive Secretary, dear colleagues, hello Marina, hello Alice, nice to see you. As President of the Portuguese Parliament Group on Population and Development, it is a great honor for this group to hold this meeting, although in the virtual form, with the Executive Secretary of the European Parliamentarian Forum for Sexual and Reproductive Rights, Neil Data. Dear Neil Data, I am very pleased to meet you in good health, and I hope that this pandemic situation didn't cause too many impacts on the work of the European Parliamentary Forum, the GPPSD of the 14th legislature was formed only on April 8 this year. This group, as always, sought to include all the parliamentarian groups, but this year this has not been the case due given the limit of the number of members and the plurality of parliamentarian groups that currently make up our parliament. But plurality persists among us and in the initiatives we hope to promote. I would like to start by presenting the honorable MPs present in this meeting, representing their respective parliamentarian groups. Member of Parliament Elsa Paes, that you know already, MP José Manuel Pureza, and Sandra, MP Sandra Pereira, and I hope so many come in during this meeting. The GPPSD has brought to the political debate new actors and contribution that transform the approach, namely on issues such as new demographies, sustainable development, sexual and reproductive rights, cooperation in maternal health, harmful practices such as FGM or child marriage, among so many others. Thought parliamentarians' resolutions, conference, seminars, working visits, hearing participation in civil society initiatives, United Nations Population and Fund, other parliamentarians, among many others. Sexual and reproductive health and rights are essential to the realization of human rights and development. This is confirmed by the multilateral agendas and commitment that Portugal is committed to with the results of the Conference on Population and Development and on Human, which go from Cairo to Beijing, confirmed in 2019. Nairobi, with the presence of the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and that fine in the Sustainable Development Goals, agreed form analysis and action. We hope to continue to mobilize debate and develop parliamentary initiatives with political decision makers, civil society and professional from public entities in the identification and presentation of proposals to promote the development of human rights approach at local, regional and international level, as well as and considering the current context in which we live, to monitor the compliance of the Portuguese government's obligation in the global vaccination policy for COVID-19, COVAX. I think it's important to say this. Today, the EPF, with the report tip of the iceberg, religious extremist funders against human rights for sexuality and reproductive health in Europe, convokes us to the importance to promote vigilance and action in the face of the growth of financial, religious and ideological movements that put at risk rights and choice in our shared humanity that we subscribe to, not leaving anyone behind. I now give the floor to Nidata so that we can tell us a little about the work of the EPF and also present to us this important report. The floor is yours, Neil. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Maria Antonia. It's really a pleasure to be here with you. Normally, I know that I would be in Lisbon right now, as I have been in previous occasions where we meet for the first time the new members of the newly reconstituted GPP-SPD. But this time, because of COVID, we need to do it this way, which is still good, but it's a pity we can't interact face-to-face like we have in the past. I just want to take a few...
Neil, please, sorry. Can you speak a little bit slowly, please?
Okay.
Thank
right.
you.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'll speak more slowly. And also, I just want to take this opportunity to congratulate all the members of the GPP-SPD for having been elected or re-elected in the most recent occasion, and for the reconstitution of your group. The Portuguese parliamentary group has been a member of EPF for over 20 years, and so you're a very valued member of the organization, and so it's glad to have you back. My intervention will be divided into two parts. First, I'll make a short introduction about EPF. So for anyone new, this will be hopefully a good introduction. And for those of you who've been members for a longer time, this hopefully will be a good refresher as to what EPF is all about. After that, I will make a much more extensive presentation about the report that the chair has already raised, and that is a recent report that we did entitled Tip of the Iceberg, which looks at the funding behind the movements working against sexual and reproductive health and rights. Okay, so first we'll start with a brief introduction of EPF. So we have a slide there. Marina is screening it. I think you can go to full screen mode, maybe. Next slide. Next slide. Yeah. Marina, next slide. Okay. So first, a little bit about EPF. Okay, so the full title, as you've heard, is European Parliamentary Forum for Sexual and Reproductive Rights. So two main things to keep in mind about EPF. First of all, is our parliamentary nature. So EPF is the only organization which groups together working groups of parliamentarians all over Europe. So we are a parliamentary organization. Secondly, we are a parliamentary organization focused exclusively on sexual and reproductive health and rights. So that is the mission of the organization. And we have altogether approximately 30 such parliamentary groups focused on sexual reproductive health and rights across Europe. Next slide. So here's an overview of the different 30 groups around Europe. And by Europe, we mean the big Europe, including Russia, Azerbaijan, etc., not just the European Union. And we have and as a parliamentary organization, we have an executive committee composed of 11 members of parliament from all the whole democratic political spectrum. So our current president is a member of parliament from Austria, from the Social Democratic Party. But we also have one of our vice presidents is from Turkey, from the Conservative AK political party. And then we also have Greens, Liberals, etc., and independents on our executive committee. In the past, we were very happy to have Portuguese members of parliament. We don't have any Portuguese MP on the executive committee at the moment, but hopefully when a position becomes available in the next year or so, there will be a candidate who can present themselves for the executive committee. Next slide, please. In terms of what does EPF do? So first, we support parliamentary activities focusing on sexual reproductive health and rights. And by this, we mean, for example, organizing conferences or study tours to developing countries about sexual reproductive health and rights, so that members of parliament who may be interested but don't necessarily have seen it firsthand, they can see what it means firsthand in a developing country. Another thing that we do is provide legislative support for members of parliament who want to advance this. So maybe you've heard recently about the report in the European Parliament called the Matic Report on Sexual Reproductive Health and Rights, which won by a big victory. This was in large part thanks to EPF and other organizations providing support to parliamentarians. And this comes after 7 years when a similar report, which was presented by your colleague, Edith Estrella, was not successful. So we see this as a very big victory for sexual and reproductive health and rights. Another area of work that we do is that of research on specific areas related to sexual reproductive health and rights. So that one area of research is on contraception, another one is on cervical cancer prevention, and then a third area, and we'll get into more details about this a bit later on, is on understanding the anti-gender movement. So that is the movement working against sexual and reproductive health and rights. I mean, this movement exists in all countries, including Portugal, but compared to other European countries, Portugal does not have too strong a movement working against sexual reproductive health and rights. And I think you'll see that your neighbors in Spain have a much more difficult time with this than you do. Next slide. In terms of events, we also organize events. In the past, because of COVID, those have been very much limited. But now that we can see an end to the, or at least an end to the COVID situation, we are organizing a first parliamentary delegation. This one will be to Copenhagen in August for the World Pride event that's taking place there. And so there, I know we had invited the Portuguese members of parliament, but there were some changes, so I think we'll need to see whether your group can be represented there. And then we will also be launching a new study where we take a look at abortion laws across Europe and to see which countries have more progressive or less progressive or conservative laws on access to abortion. This will be planned for end of September. And then also we organize bilateral meetings with our member APPGs upon their request, and hopefully we'll be resuming this as soon as we can and as soon as we're able to travel once more. Next slide, please. So here I'll say a little bit about the next subject of the presentation, which is research and anti-gender organizations. So as you've seen, we've noticed a rise in coercive movements both within and outside the European Union, which are challenging and contesting very basic notions of gender equality, women's rights, LGBT rights, and reproductive rights overall. And so there's been a number of different areas of contestation that have taken place over the past 10 years. One thing that we've noticed is that we haven't understood very well how are these anti-gender organizations organizing, and then also in order to organize, how are they fundraising in order to influence policies. We've seen that also there's been an increasing interlinkages between these anti-gender movements, which are from civil society, and then forming alliances with political parties. And what we see across Europe is that these are alliances with the far right, alt-right, or populist political parties, depending on how they are called in different national contexts. And so with this report that I'll be presenting next, we take a look at what do we know about the financing behind this movement as a first step in understanding how it is that we can organize about to resist this movement. So that's a little bit about why we research anti-gender organizations. And at least one good thing about COVID is that the lockdown has allowed us to focus more on research over the past few months. Next slide, please. So in terms of the research on these anti-gender organizations, we have come out with three reports up until now. The first one came out in 2018, was entitled Restoring the Natural Order. That's where we reveal how these anti-gender actors working against sexual reproductive health and rights, against LGBT, against gender equality, and even against children's rights, are all coordinated within a specific network called Agenda Europe. The next report that we released was last year, entitled Modern Day Crusaders, which takes a look at a specific network which is active mainly in Eastern Europe and specifically in Poland. So that I'm sure you've heard about what's been happening in Poland, which is not very good, about the near abortion ban which is currently in place in Poland, about these so-called LGBT free zones, which have been both of which have been condemned by the European Parliament. This organization behind these initiatives in Poland, called Ordo Iuris, is itself the modern expression of a network that originated in Brazil in the 1960s called Tradition, Family and Property, or the Brazilian Portuguese version of that, Tradição, Família e Propriedades, which we thought had died in the late 1990s, but has reappeared in Eastern Europe. And then finally, we have a report that we released just a few weeks ago called Tip of the Iceberg, which will look at the funding behind these organizations. Next slide. So I think with that, I'll end here. Maybe before going on to the presentation of Tip of the Iceberg, I should open up to see if there are any questions or comments that anyone would like to make.
Okay, thank you, Neil. I think this document is undoubtedly a valuable contribution to understand what is behind this conservative and even extremist movements. Neil points out concrete values and a name, which is alarming. After all, those in power, the multimillionaires and millionaire organization want to reserve acquired rights, and these are not only human rights, but only women rights, but human rights as whole. I will now give the floor to MPs. To MPs, but I asked if you have already some words to say about the report. I don't know. I think
maybe
give the floor to the MPs to ask questions.
Maybe I can present the report now, and then this would be a more fruitful discussion for the MPs.
Okay, but so I think after.
Yes.
After is the it's more okay. Yeah. You have the floor, Neil. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marina. Can you screen the tip of the iceberg report? Okay. So here we have. This is the presentation on the report, tip of the iceberg. Okay. Next slide, please. Okay, so first, in terms of the structure of the report, this report takes a look at funding for these anti-gender organizations over a 10-year period stretching from 2009 to 2018. And in terms of how we structured the report, we will take a look at one, in the first part, where does the money come from in terms of geography? Second, we take a look at how the funding is raised, and then we put this together in a number of case studies, how it all fits together. Now, in terms of methodology, what we did is that we identified approximately 120 anti-gender actors active at European and national level all over Europe. We were able to track the financial data for only 54 of these anti-gender entities. We then examined their governance structures to see who are they linked with, and then we took a look at the academic and media literature to see about further associations, and as I said, we cover a 10-year period. So that's a bit about the foundations for this report. Next slide, please. So first, in terms of overall funding, so for this movement working against human rights on sexuality and reproduction and LGBT rights, we were able to find that there is at least $700 million funding this movement over the past 10 years. These are $700 million. These are the budgets of these 54 entities, which are NGOs, foundations, religious organizations, and in some cases, political parties. And we can see that there's three main geographic origins. One is the United States, another one is the Russian Federation, and then the third, by far the biggest one, is the European Union itself. Then what we can see over this 10-year period is that there has been a fourfold increase in funding for these anti-gender organizations. So just imagine you as members of parliament and Alice from civil society, you're all familiar with funding. If your budget increases by four over a 10-year period, you can do a lot more with that than you could 10 years ago. And this is what we're seeing happening across Europe. Next slide, please. So first, we'll take a look at the first source of funding, the United States. What we see is that there's 10 organizations, NGOs and think tanks, which are based in the United States, which account for over $80 million of the funding spent in Europe over this past 10 years. They have been able to establish a specific area of anti-gender activism, which is legal and lobbying infrastructure in the EU, so that they have offices in Brussels, Vienna, Geneva, etc., which then are really influencing European human rights institutions. They are seeking credibility by registering on the EU Transparency Register, seeking accreditation with the Council of Europe, etc. And what we see is that all of these organizations are linked with what are called the mega donors of the Republican Party and of the US Christian right. So basically, over the past 4 years, when you have heard of billionaires backing the Trump presidency and the Republican Party, it is the same billionaires that have been funding these issues in Europe. Next slide, please. So here is, you can see it better in the report, but we were able to identify basically as how the money gets to Europe. So basically you have private, you have billionaires in the United States, the DeVos family, the Prince family, the Templeton family, etc. They have their own private wealth. They then establish private foundations. Like this, they get fiscal advantages in the United States. With these private foundations, they then fund organizations linked with the US Christian right. So think tanks, NGOs, etc. And then a certain number of these US Christian right organizations then establish offices in Europe or spend money in Europe through conferences, etc. So that's how the money starts from the United States and then reaches Europe. Next slide. And so here you can see this is a map of where the US organizations are based in Europe. Brussels, Strasbourg, Geneva, Vienna, London, and of course Rome. Many of these are religiously linked. And these are the organizations which have been launching legal cases against human rights in sexuality and reproduction across Europe and before the European courts. Next slide, please. Next, we turn to the Russian Federation. From the Russian Federation, we could identify three types of funding flows from Russia to Europe. One is through oligarchs. Another one is through laundromats. So these are ways of channeling dark, hidden money. And then third are Russian state agencies, which promote anti-gender positions. From the Russian Federation, we were able to identify over $188 million coming specifically from two Russian oligarchs and a whole range of different entities that they have created, which a number of observers call influence factories. So next slide, please. So in terms of Russian anti-gender funding in Europe, we can see that it starts from nowhere in 2012, and then all of a sudden it goes up very, very, very quickly. And then in 2014, it goes back down. The reason for this is that the EU imposed sanctions on the Russian Federation, and then those sanctions were effective in limiting the flow of Russian money to Europe. Now, in order to understand the Russian money to Europe, you need to understand two main figures, two oligarchs, Vladimir Yakunin and Konstantin Malafeyev. Both of them have featured on the list of banned individuals by Western countries because of their involvement in Eastern Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea. Both of them have created a whole range of different legal entities which act as a smokescreen for how money can be flows from one place to another, and then these entities then interact with different US and European actors, including, for example, the Spanish-based organization Citizen Go, which organizes petitions against anything progressive, or European far-right political parties. So this is how, and for example, there's well-attested links between these Russian actors and far-right political parties in France with the Rassemblement National and in Italy with the La Lega. And also increasingly with Spain with the Vox and Germany with the Alternative für Deutschland. Next slide. So here's an example of how the Russian money gets into Europe. So you can see Russian actors funding or supporting or engaging with different actors in Western Europe. So in Spain, France, Italy is a big hotspot, Hungary as well, and Germany. Next slide. So now we come to the part about Europe, okay? So Europe accounts for the biggest source of funding for these anti-gender actors at over $437 million dollars over this 10-year period. And we can track this down to 20 private foundations based in the European Union. And then these are organized around five new transnational networks which have emerged in Europe. So these and one of these networks works against abortion rights, another one against LGBT rights, a third one is specialized in social media mobilization, a fourth one is what we can call a pseudo-Catholic far-right network, and then fifth we have a Protestant Christian political party that has also emerged. All of these are new entities that have emerged mainly around 2012, 2013, and now are active. So if you see this big increase in funding from less than $20 million per year to more than $60 million per year over a 10-year period, this is because those actors have organized in different ways and then from that have been able to generate more money. Next slide. So in terms of the private European foundations, we can see that they're mainly based in Germany, France, Italy. There's one in one in Spain. And some common characteristics that they have is that they are associated with social, economic, and political elites. In some cases, for example, in Germany, they are linked with the former aristocracy. So you have lots of duchesses and counts and countesses involved in this. In some other countries, it is religious elites that are very active. Or in Spain and in Italy, it is former politicians, members of parliament from center-right political parties that then create foundations. One thing we can see is that almost all of them are not at all transparent about their funding. And then a number of them have been involved in different European citizens' initiatives against abortion rights and against LGBT rights, and they were the main funders of these initiatives. Next slide, please. So here's an overview of the anti-gender networks in Europe. So there's the first one against abortion is entitled One of Us, generating over $31 million dollars. Another one against LGBT rights. The third one, the Christian political activism. Fourth one is the online petitioning. And then the fourth one is a pseudo-Catholic far-right mobilization of tradition, family, and property. Right now, most influential in Poland, which also over this 10-year period has been able to generate at least $113 million for its activism. So if you're generating that amount, then that explains in part how they have been so successful in Poland in going against abortion and LGBT rights, and then from Poland expanding into other European countries. Next slide. So now I'll take a look at what's beneath the iceberg. So you have the $700 million spent over the past 10 years, but how did they generate this money? So there's four ways that they generated this money: through grassroots fundraising and astroturfing, social media, social and economic elites, state support. So a number of them get money from public bodies, and then through religious networks. Next slide. So in terms of astroturfing, what we can see is that there's several models of this, but basically it consists of organizing petitions. Like this, you get petitions on certain issues. Like this, you get a range of different subscribers. You have email addresses. Once you have these email addresses, this is like gold dust. This is very valuable because once you have the email addresses, you can go back to them and ask them for contributions. And so this is what's been happening in a range of East European countries, but also Germany and in Spain. In Spain specifically, what they have been doing is then making political statements in favor of certain issues where they profile as being very good the far-right political party Vox, and then they show how all the other political parties are not as good. And so this is a way of political campaigning without needing to declare the funding as a political campaign contribution. Next slide. Then we have social and economic elites. What we see in every country where this phenomenon has happened is that there's links with the business community. So that in Europe, we have our own millionaires and billionaires, just like in the United States, and they are the ones very often backing alt-right or far-right political parties. I know that in Portugal, there was a very good expose which linked how the top industrial families of Portugal were also involved with the rise of the Chega political party. But this Portuguese story, just imagine the same thing is happening in Germany, in Italy, in France, in Spain, in Poland, and elsewhere. One specificity that we have in Europe is that in a number of countries we still have aristocratic families that exist. These they may have lost their title and privileges, but they never lost their wealth or real estate. And so these are important economic actors, for example, in Germany and in Austria, and they play a role in anti-gender organizations. Next slide, please. So here's a quick overview of some of the main corporate actors, these economic elites in Europe that are backing anti-gender organizations. So you have some that I'm sure you'll recognize: Carrefour, AXA, El Corte Inglés, Freixenet, which all have established links with funding certain anti-gender actors. Next slide. We also have these anti-gender actors being able to tap into public support, so money from the government, in certain main categories. One is to mislead women by giving them false information about their pregnancies with a view to dissuading them about abortion. Another one is indoctrinating youth by developing their own school curricula, which specifically omit sexuality education. A third area is funding from the state in order to organize into political parties. And in some countries, it has become very advanced where the government provides funding to ultra-conservative anti-gender organizations as being legitimate representatives of civil society, which then take on supportive positions of the government's anti-human rights agenda. We have this specifically in Poland and in Hungary. And then finally, we have the state directly engaging in anti-gender diplomacy, specifically Russia, Hungary, Poland, in the state using the apparatus of the state in order to advance anti-human rights ideas, be it on religious freedom, demography, women's rights, etc. Next slide, please. And then finally, we have religious networks where we can see that in Europe, they're organized around the main religious the main religious persuasions present in Europe. So the biggest and most extensive of these are Catholic networks. So we have different we have the official representation of the Conference of European Bishops working in partnership with some of the American and European anti-gender actors in order to advance anti-human rights positions in EU institutions. And another example is that in a number of cases, we have members of the Catholic clergy, cardinals, for example, being directly involved in the leadership of organizations undermining human rights. A second category are the Protestant networks, mainly around the Dutch Reformed Church in the Netherlands, where they organize parliamentary prayer breakfasts, which are meant to be open to all people, but there they gradually put in messages which undermine human rights, such as LGBT rights. And then finally, we have Orthodox networks in Eastern Europe, where there we see that, for example, the Orthodox churches are becoming increasingly active in mobilizing against what they call gender ideology. So that, for example, it was the Orthodox churches which were among the main organizers against the Istanbul Convention in some East European countries. Next slide. So in terms of overall trends in the funding for the anti-gender actors, we can identify five main trends. One is that there are new transnational coalitions emerging. Secondly, we are going from what was previously a normative or a policy project wanting to influence, for example, abortion law or LGBT rights or things like this. Now it is becoming a political project being housed within far-right and alt-right populist political parties. Third is that we have a new anti-gender social media platform, which can be very powerful. Fourth, we have a professionalized presence of for lobbying and litigation at the EU. This is new as of the last 10 years. And then fifth is that these anti-gender actors have allies inside the political power structures at all levels, at member state level and and inside the European institutions. Next slide. So here's an example of one of these anti-gender networks, which you can see has been co-sponsored by a number of different actors. So there you have the Agenda Europe network as such, being co-sponsored by American actors, Citizen Go from Spain, European Christian Political Movement funded by the EU, Ordo Iuris affiliated with Tradition, Family and Property originally from Brazil, and then also a Vatican-created theological institute. So you can see all of them working together in a joint network. Next slide, please. And so in terms of what does this mean now, if we take a look at what I said earlier in terms of the Matic report, there was a big mobilization against the Matic report just a few weeks ago. And you can see all of these different logos. These were the organizations behind it. Next slide. So I think I'll end here, and I'm open to any questions or comments that you may have. So thank you very much for your attention. I know it was a lot of information.
As I said, this document is undoubtedly a valuable contribution to understanding what is behind these conservative movements. So thank you once again, Neil. I think it's a great report of what we are now facing to these problems we have. Now I'm going to give the floor to MPs who want to ask questions. Senhora Deputada Elsa Paes, please, you have the floor.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, President. First of all, I would like to start by greeting the President and Neil Data and your team of EPF and, of course, Alice Frade. It's a pleasure to stay here with you. Thank you for the information, Neil Data, and concerns that you spoke about. The growth of anti-gender movements in the European Union is very, very, for us, very, very worrying. It is a movement against women's rights and against the achievement made, a movement against European values. Portugal was a country that in the last 10 years has made a great development in achieved the human rights of women and of LGBT key people, for instance, in the laws, marriage between people of the same sex, adoption by same-sex couple, medical assisted procreation of for all women, and so on. Portugal has a great tradition in policies that respect human rights as a central issue of women dignity. Human rights are a constitutional principle respected in our public policies. At the international level, it is important to remember the, as you said before, Cairo Conference and the Beijing Platform Action, which were central both to the human rights and the sexual and reproductive rights of all people around the world. the limitation on human rights that the report talks about limit the freedom of women and other LGBT people. Limiting people's rights is a path that the European Union of Rights must reject, because it violates our founding values, gender equality and equality, and also it the way to poverty and less development, as is referred in UNFPA studies. In this moment, the pandemic crisis introduced very concerns about Turkey, exit from Istanbul Convention, about Poland against abortion, about Hungary against human rights of LGBTQ people. The question that should be asked will be, how can European Union together stop these movements that are growing, as you just mentioned, with suspicious funding coming from religious and political extremism? And the other question, what can we do as parliamentarians to denounce and prevent the advance of these movements that don't respect the European values? And another, with the COVID pandemic, are there any studies that predict an increase in funding of these movements? Thank you.
Thank you. Now, MP Sandra Pereira, please.
Thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to meet Nildata again and work with EPF. I want to congratulate EPF for this report, which is an important tool to work together against extremist movements. I'm so glad to know, I think Neil says this on the presentation, that Portugal does not have a strong movement and a strong work against sexual and reproductive rights. This is a good news. And we know the importance of birth rates and the collective future, and our collective future are linked to the recognition of women, women's rights and gender equality. This is a present and a future commitment to humanity, and we must work every day on it. It's a commitment, important commitment. And I would like to suggest that we could do a conference, a summit with this topic of discussion here, probably inviting others, MP of other countries. It's a suggestion with our GPP. And I would like to ask, what has been the reaction to the report, for example, with the organizations and the countries' reference on this research? And what can we do to stop these movements that we know are growing up, and this is so scared to us? Thank you.
I don't know if any MP want to ask.
Please.
Yes. MP José Manuel Pureza, please.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. I'd like to greet Nildata and the EPF, not only for this specific report, but also for all the work that EPF has been developing so far. which is extremely important as an instrument for our own intervention in our countries, and namely here in Portugal. This report addresses a very important question, a yet non-answered question, which is the funding of these far-right extremist forces, which are unequivocally growing in all European countries and all over the world also. And the question of funding is of the utmost importance to understand the kind of network which is established at the bottom. So the image of a tip of an iceberg is extremely useful to understand, you know, the deep and rooted phenomena which we are witnessing. We are aware of some part of this funding dynamic, namely around the so-called movement that has been created and leaded by Steve Bannon, whose headquarters are in Italy, which is important to be reminded. But obviously this report goes further in analyzing the labyrinth and the kind of mixed influences, both religious, political, ideological, etc., which converge to the funding of the far right, namely in its actions against women's rights and sexual and reproductive rights. I really would not like to make to put a question, but to make a general comment on some elements of the report, and I would like to be very brief. The first note is only to underline the fact that one of the crucial features of the current discourse of the far right all over the world is the use of an alleged ideology, gender ideology, they call it like that, as a threat to be eradicated, and which is no more and no less than the struggle for gender and sex equality. In fact, they call it gender ideology, but in fact, what they are fighting against is the equality rights and the autonomy rights of women all over the world. So this discourse matches religious conservatism, which is favorable to the subalternization of women, not only in churches but in society. And it matches also a political extremism, which sees in the equality of women a threat, a danger, something to be eradicated, because it anticipates undesirable, from their point of view, changes in the social fabric. The second note is that the report puts us before facing a reality that goes far beyond the single topic of sexual and reproductive rights and gender equality, because we should combine this topic with other topics that are also very much present in the discourse and in the concrete action of these entities, namely gypsy phobia or racism or the securitization of differences or the infiltration in security forces or the anti-vaccine denial or the criminalization of migrations. This group of topics makes a whole in which the funding is, you know, very much important to bring the discourse into concrete political and sometimes criminal action, most of the times criminal action. And finally, the third comment is that, yes, it's true that Portugal is not present in this picture, both of funding countries and of funded countries or funded movements. It's true. But the fact is that we all know that Portugal is a country in which the strength, the visibility, and the action of these kind of movements against not only sexual and reproductive rights, but of a whole set of rights of gender equality and of other topics linked with the principle of equality, these movements are growing in Portugal. It is to be noted that the growing importance that has come to the parliament in this very moment is a threat to our democracy. So the questioning of funding also in Portugal, the questioning of funding for propaganda actions, for political intervention, for meetings, for organizations is of extreme importance. Despite the fact that we happily don't belong to the dark list that is present in this report, we as Democrats, as people who fight for equality, are supposed to put the same question that the report has put itself to our own reality. And with this, I finish my long intervention. Sorry for this. And I would like to once again thank Neil Data and the EPF team for this extremely important instrument for our political intervention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, MP Carla Miranda, please.
Good morning, everybody. I really want to thank this document, which is really encourages for us to find more about these subversive movements. Of course, Mr. Neil Data and its team, thank you a lot. We know that if we want to understand what's going on, we have to follow the money, which is always the same thing we have to do with everything, which is follow the money. I wanted to ask you if you think that in a way the COVID special moment that we've been through has been helping in a way all these movements to grow. And I want to ask you this because in a way it seems to me that it can be part of a perfect storm for these movements to grow. And I ask, and the reason I say this is because COVID brought really restrictions on our freedoms and rights in many countries, one more than the others. Women, in a way, return to men in most all the countries to their natural places, homes for these guys. These guys, it's homes. We lose the public space, so we lose that freedom of movement and defending ourselves. Many of the of women lost their work in this pandemic, which we know the numbers, we know they happened. So in a way, that's also good for them. So they won't be back to the work. Many reproductive and sexual rights consultations on the health system were lost in this time. Many abortion consultations were lost. So in a way, all of these rights were compromised during this period. Freedoms were compromised. So what I wanted to ask you was and of course we all know that in many cases, we know this data, that in many parts of the world, many democracies were lost in all of this the spirits, the numbers, we know that. So in a way, if I'm asking you, which, are we going in an era, a new era of conservatism? But is it COVID like accelerating this movement? Do we have data that says that many of these restrictions will be going on, will be, many of country of this country will be defending this stopping of rights for women in Europe? Because, I mean, we live in Europe, we live, it's like a light of democracy. We don't have many places to go there. You know, we have Europe, we have to defend what we have. This is not ours, this is not the story we have. I mean, we have to know what we're defending. So in a way, what I wanted to ask is it that COVID, this incredible thing that happened to us and all over the world, in Europe, do you think it's helping these movements to grow and in a way to stand and continuing? And what can we, groups like this one, like our group, can do to make a difference on the stopping of the movement, try to do something about this? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. At last, but not the least, I want to make a question that in Portugal we will have local elections in September this year. Do these movements increase with the election approach? It's a question that I want to know if you have some opinion about this. Thank you.
Okay.
I think now you can answer, okay. Please.
Okay. Thank you very much. So thank you very much for the feedback and the comments and the remarks on the report. Thank you very much. I'll take some of the questions, not necessarily in order, but by how I think how the answers are coming to my mind. In relation to Carla Miranda's question about the impact of COVID, what we've seen so far is that I think maybe we have to differentiate it into two levels. One, with the impact of the first lockdowns, there was a sudden and drastic loss of access, including to human rights and medical services, which was unforeseeable. And so women lost access to abortion and contraception, etc. And that's because the lockdowns, as we all remember, they came from 1 week to the next, and there was not enough time to prepare for that. And if you remember also the lockdowns, at least for us in Belgium and in France, they were meant to be for an initial period of 4 weeks, then they were extended, etc. And so we were ill prepared for that, and this led to a loss of rights and medical services. But then there comes the question of political will. What we saw is that in a number of countries, when the realization of what was happening hit politicians, in a number of countries, they were able to come up with solutions so that women can access abortion or contraception or different things. So that, for example, in Italy, it was previously for a woman to access medical abortion, she had to make an appointment with a doctor and then take the pills inside a hospital bed. But remember, during COVID, the hospital beds were full, especially in Italy in 2020. So this meant that it was de facto unavailable. But then they changed the policy so as to allow for home use of these medical abortion pills. And we also have examples in other countries. So that in Ireland, a woman had to go through a counseling session before accessing an abortion. But counseling session previously was done face-to-face, person-to-person, whereas you can't do that when everyone is in lockdown. So they found a remedy of doing this by telemedicine via webinar. So on the one hand, in a number of countries, there were solutions found where there was political will. But equally, there was the opposite political will in a number of countries, and those actors which had authoritarian or illiberal leanings used COVID to really undermine human rights and further go backwards. So that we have the example in Poland, where under the first lockdown, the government, during lockdown, decides to propose a law against abortion. Now, there's no need for this, but the Polish activists say the government did this because they were not, because protests were going to be illegal because no one was allowed to gather in large groups. So that was one way of doing this. Hungary has introduced a number of issues against LGBT rights. Now, the LGBT community in Hungary is not asking for anything, but these measures are going against their rights, and there's absolutely no reason for this, but it does serve the Orbán government with a very useful tool so that he's doing anti-LGBT issues, initiatives. He's being criticized by Europe. Then he decides to organize a referendum on these issues. This was announced just this week. The referendum will come out in his favor. And then like this, he can go back and confront the European leaders saying he has democratic legitimacy. And then like this, he can use this to bolster himself against criticism from the EU. And the EU will keep giving money for him and his allies in order to maintain the kleptocratic state he's established. So I think we need to see it in that context as well. So in terms of COVID, there's two different areas, and it really is linked to political will. That's one thing. In terms of the question posed by Maria Antonia about elections, what we've observed in a number of different countries is that, yes, elections are an organizing moment for these anti-gender groups. They will put pressure on all the democratic political parties. Some of them will be more receptive to them or not. I would imagine that the newly emergent Cega party will be very receptive to these demands coming from anti-gender actors. And then they will put pressure on other political parties also who may be less or more receptive to them. So elections are always a moment to be watchful for in terms of their potential pressure points. Next, there was also the question of what can be done about these anti-gender movements, and also specifically in Portugal. As I said, and also as was mentioned by several others, this movement is not very well developed in Portugal yet. This doesn't mean it cannot be, and this does not mean that it will not be in Portugal. So you really need to be vigilant about how this movement progresses in your country. I think you know better than even I how quickly Chega has emerged. Okay, Portugal for a long time was on the list of countries where there is no anti-gender movement. Now you are on the list of an emerging anti-gender movement. Okay, and you just need to take a look at your neighbors. Vox political party, a number of years ago, it was scoring less than 3% in national elections. Now it is the third political force in the country, and it is in regional governments in some places. So I think if anything, at this point, politicians in Portugal need to be taking a look at what has happened in other countries so that if and when it does happen in your country, you are prepared to recognize it for what it is. Perhaps another thing that you can do in Portugal is, as José Manuel Pérez mentioned, these movements are growing in strength in Portugal. Okay, one thing that maybe you can do is to have clarity about who are these movements. They will often present themselves as being national organizations of pure, simple Christians who simply are working for local initiatives. But when you scratch the surface, what you will often find is that they are very well connected internationally. They're probably very well connected to business centers, industrialists, and important religious actors. They will often not be financially transparent. So before engaging with them and giving them credibility about what it is that they're asking for, then you need to do a bit of homework also and really questioning what is their actual credibility and not take their statements at face value. And then Sandra was asking about the reaction of the anti-gender organizations to the report that we launched. The anti-gender organizations were not happy, not happy at all with our report, tip of the iceberg, so that they issued declarations against us. And also one of them has even initiated legal proceedings against us. This is the Spanish organization Citizen Go, which sent us a lawyer letter saying that what we said is not good. So we're in the process of dealing with that. So I think also just to point out that if they're going that far by criticizing us and by engaging in potential legal action, then this activity is something that then transparency on their own finances is something that they don't want. What we find is that often when you shine the light on the anti-gender organizations, they don't like it and they scurry away like rats. They don't want anyone to know about them. And then finally, there was Elsa who was asking about the funding of the anti-gender movements and what do we know about them. Well, unfortunately, the only thing we know about them is what's presented in the report. It's the first report of its kind that takes a look at this. But what I'm hoping is that it can serve as a foundation for others to then look further into this, so that maybe in Portugal, you're able to see, well, there's these organizations that exist, what information do we know about them? And then you can help complete the picture that we have about this at European level. And then others in other countries will do the same. And then we can start seeing what it is that we can do about them, and to see eventually about whether there's actions we can do to demonetize them. What we saw is in a certain number of countries, they are supported by industrial or commercial actors which have a good reputation. Does their association with anti-gender actors, if that were to become public, will it harm the brand of these organizations? If so, that's something we need to investigate further. So I think maybe I'll leave you with these ideas. But really, I think the most important one is that Portugal now is at a state where, at a very enviable state, where the problem you have is still manageable. If you are vigilant and on top of this, then hopefully you can keep it within control, and which is more than what some other countries have. And I would say also, this movement can hit any European country. One of the countries where this movement has grown the most recently has been in the Netherlands. So progressive Netherlands, and so you have time. So I think I've spoken enough. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much for your participation, and thank you very much for this brilliant work, which explores this more hidden side of such a complex phenomenon of these anti-gender movements. Maybe we can promote a meeting with other countries like France, Italy, and Spain, for example. We think in next October or November, maybe Portugal can do something about this. So I don't know if anyone wants to speak now. Okay, thank you very much, Neil, Marina, Alice, and I hope you have a good holidays, and see you next September. Thank you. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
Obrigada, senhores deputados, por terem estado presentes, mas temos todas outras reuniões dos nossos grupos parlamentares, e foi, de facto, com muito esforço que viemos aqui e fizemos esta reunião, mas eu penso que valeu a pena. Tivemos conhecimento de um relatório inédito e que nos informa desta forma de financiamento destas organizações. De facto, temos que olhar para isto com outros olhos. Muito obrigada a todos. E a quem não vê mais, boas férias.